All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you. Be seated, everyone. I'm pleased to take up the third case of our docket here in Bingham County for August 23rd. We appreciate the patience. This case is entitled CCR LLC versus Teton County. Teton County Appeals and is represented by Greg Hall. The cross-appellant respondent is TCR LLC, represented by Jeffrey Bronson. Counsel, either of you have any preliminary matters for us today?
No, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Hall, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Chief Justice and distinguished members of the court, this is an interesting case because it's an old case. By that I mean Teton Creek Resort PUD was approved in Teton County back in 1995. And as part of that approval, the county provided 17 conditions that needed to be met for the PUD to proceed forward. One of those conditions was a site development plan. And the record demonstrates that the developer at the time met all 17 conditions, and the development began to be developed. In fact, as you look, you have this in the record, this site development plan, but it's so small it's very sometimes a little difficult for you to see, and so I brought a blown-up copy of it, thinking that it may be of some assistance. The top half of this PUD was developed by the original developer shortly after the development was approved. However, as sometimes occurs, when there was a downturn in the economy, the developer went bankrupt. And the current appellant, or a current owner of the property, purchased the property out of bankruptcy, and he owns the lower portion. So, if I may, this was developed previously. This is the area that we're concerned about. And in particular, this case involves this lot right here that I've tried to outline in yellow. Hopefully, that is helpful. When the site development plan was submitted, that was actually lot 17. In Europe, at this time, it is not lot 17. It is lot 12B. And you may ask, well, why is it lot 12B? Well, that is because after the new developer purchased this property, he came to the county on three separate occasions and requested the opportunity to amend the plat of the PUD, and in that process, renumbered this lot to 12B. That's an interesting process because on each of these three occasions, the request that the developer made to the county commissioners, in fact, was approved. Then they came on a fourth occasion. And this case arises out of that fourth occasion.
Can I stop you there for just a second, Mr. Hall?
Yes.
So the three changes, those were classified as insignificant changes. Is that correct? Could you explain what makes a change insignificant?
I'm probably not as well... It's defined within the ordinance, the Teton County ordinance itself. And there are five factors that they look at. And I apologize to the court, but I do not have those five factors memorized. But they look at those five factors to make a determination as to whether or not it is an insignificant plat amendment. And the first plat amendments were simply changing lot lines. Didn't change anything else other than lot lines, except for the fact that by changing the lot line, they requested to be able to have, instead of 10 condominiums, which were approved in the format that you can see here, in two high-rise buildings, they asked to be able to build more condominiums, and county commissioners approved that because the lot had been enlarged slightly to be able to build 16 condominiums. So they actually increased the number of condominiums allowed on lot 12B by 60%.
And was that considered insignificant too?
That was.
And at that time, the staff notes, as I see in the record from the second and third amendment applications, indicated that the change would also result in a difference from the conceptual plans of having one or two buildings to individual units.
On the last plat amendment, yes.
Well, I saw it in the notes on the second and the third.
That's correct. They came on the fourth occasion, and again the staff had indicated that in staff's opinion it was an insignificant plat amendment, where they went from having no sort of two buildings with 10 condominiums or three buildings with 16 condominiums, and they changed it to 16 separate residences. All with their own garages, their own driveways, their own yards. They were manufactured homes that they were placing that simply would be what is normally in a subdivision, but not the type that was anticipated by a PUD. As you know, a PUD is a special process where you enter into an interactive process between the local government and the developer. And as a result of entering into that process, under a PUD, you're entitled to obtain a higher level of density in your subdivision than you otherwise would receive. And in conjunction with that, you then make other compromises with the local government. In this case, those compromises are reflected in the site development plan that was provided to the county at the time of the approval of this plat. And The portion that was developed consistent with that.
Mr. Hall, I didn't see anywhere in the record where the Teton County Commissioners required development to proceed in accordance with the site plan. All I saw was a preliminary plat approval condition for the submission of a site plan, but I don't see where anybody ever said, and you have to build it out in accordance with the site plan.
The conditions were set forth by the planning and zoning, the P&Z board. And then the county commissioners adopted the findings of the P&Z board.
And I didn't see those findings in the record. I saw minutes where...
I would agree, back in 1995, the reflection is in the minutes of the Board of County Commissioners' minutes rather than in a separate written findings, facts, and conclusions.
But the minutes aren't the findings of fact and conclusions of law, are they?
No, they're not. And in fact, under that approach, the county commissioners never issued any findings of fact and conclusions of law with regard to the creation of the PUD.
And so I'm back to where in the record is there evidence that the board of county commissioners said you have to build it out in accordance with this site plan? Because all I see is the board of county commissioners read the findings of fact and conclusions of law and adopted them, but I don't have those findings of fact and conclusions of law in this record.
That's the problem with the case that's 30 years old. All we have is the minutes.
Plus, you suggested that site plan was a part of the 1995 determination.
And correct.
The first indication that is the site plan applicable doesn't appear until 1997.
That is correct. There was litigation for a number of years. There were three cases of litigation involving this PUD before it was finally approved and reached a settlement in the third litigation, in the third item of litigation. And after that, shortly after that was approved, the planning and zoning administrator, wanting to make sure that everyone knew what the site development plan was, what the rights and privileges of the parties were, prepared an affidavit and recorded that affidavit. We refer to it in the record as the Nemeth affidavit, Leslie Nemeth affidavit, wherein she attached this site development plan to her affidavit, wherein she states, I'm familiar with this process, all the litigation, everything that's led up to the adoption of this PUD, And this is the site development plan that was approved as part of the condition of approval of the PUD.
That's not what her affidavit says, though. I read her affidavit very carefully. At no point did I see, and so you tell me the language you're relying on where you think she says the commissioners required approval.
She doesn't ever mention the commissioners.
Right. Right. All she says is I was involved, and the final plat accurately set forth blah, 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 and, you know, the purpose of this affidavit is to summarize and record the specifications applicable. But she's not a commissioner. So I'm struggling with why she gets to say they have to comply with this when she's not the one who can authorize it.
She is recording what was presented to the P&Z board. And I simply refer you to the City of Eagle versus Two Rivers Subdivision Homeowners Association, wherein this court held that developers are bound by the representations made at public meetings. And I believe that the name affidavit, at the minimum, creates a question of fact to be resolved as to whether or not this is the site development plan that was presented at the public meetings. I think that it's clear to me, at least, that's what the name of the affidavit establishes, and that the developer, in fact, should be bound by what was presented to the public as what they were going to do as part of this PUD.
I don't see anywhere in her affidavit where she says the developer showed up and presented this to the Board of County Commissioners or to P&Z and represented that they would construct this development in accordance with this site plan. I just don't see that in her affidavit.
In the, I think you have to put two and two together. In the approval by the Planning and Zoning Commission, it lists out the requirements,
And we have minutes. We don't actually have any order from Planning and Zoning. We have minutes of their meeting, and they're not even signed by the Planning and Zoning Commissioners.
So we have those minutes, which set forth the 17 conditions required for this development to occur.
And I don't see where they said those 17 conditions imposed an obligation to comply with the site plan. When I look at the minutes, all it says is site plan met.
That's correct. They said this is the conditions of approval, and then they subsequently state all of these 17 conditions have been met.
And the condition of approval on, I think it's page 57, 58 of the record, just says a final site plan will be submitted for review.
And the minutes indicate that site plan was submitted because it indicates that all conditions were met.
And so my question is, how does that impose an obligation to build it exactly according to the site plan and to have to come back and seek amendment if you want to deviate?
And to follow up on that, why wasn't the site plan amended by those three earlier proceedings or the two earlier proceedings of the planning of the Teton County Commissions in which they found this changes were insignificant?
Because they found that the changes were insignificant, there wasn't a need to amend the site development plan. Once they reached a conclusion that the amendment was significant or substantial, then that requires an amendment to the site development plan. And that's what the county commissioners held on October 13th of 2020.
So aren't they going back in time and saying, we said these were insignificant, but now we're changing our mind and they're really substantial?
Not at all, because what they are simply saying is this is the first time you've presented to the county a plat which shows a substantial difference in how you're going to construct these projects as compared to what was represented at the public meetings.
Didn't the developer suggest that it was going to use 16 different lots with individual houses on those lots before this determination?
No.
That was not approved by the Teton County Commission?
No.
What about the staff notes associated with the Second and Third Amendments in 2018 and 2019, which say this is also a deviation from the conceptual plan that showed one or two buildings, and now they're proposing individual units?
Well, I apologize. I don't think it says they're proposing individual units. They say that they're going to be proposing a different form of construction. the question really becomes at this point, what we at least see is the confusion that has existed in this case is because of that October 13, 2020 decision, there have now been three lawsuits filed. Three lawsuits filed almost simultaneously. First lawsuit was this deck action. Second lawsuit was an appeal under LUPA. And now, a year later, a subsequent lawsuit, which is in federal court and has been stayed pending the outcome of this litigation. So what we have occurring here is that the Idaho legislature anticipated these types of proceedings to proceed under LUPA and not to proceed through a deck action. And this court has reiterated that on a number of occasions, that the proper process is a LUPA process. And the TCR knew that, and they filed an appeal under LUPA.
But they're not challenging a land use decision in this case. They're arguing you breached the settlement agreement, and you're in violation of 55-15-23 by not recording, approving and recording our condominium plat. So what is, with those two claims, what's the land use decision being appealed?
Well, with regard to the first issue, can I defer the issue of the breach of the settlement agreement, and I want to address the issue with regard to the land use issue. And in this case, the commissioners found that they had made a significant modification, substantial modification. This proposed plat was a substantial modification. Once they reached that conclusion that it's a substantial modification, then if you disagree with that under LUPA, you can appeal that decision to the district court, which is exactly what they did.
But they're not challenging that decision in this case. In this case, you're saying you had they're saying you breached and you had an obligation to record our condominium plat. That's all they're saying. They're not challenging the 2020 or 2021, sorry, I can't remember when it was, decision. So I'm struggling to see why LUPA applies.
Well, the argument, of course, is that we are supposedly saying that there's no land use. The court is suggesting there's no land use decision here. The county obviously concluded otherwise, and the appellants believed otherwise because they filed a LUPA appeal. With regard to the issue of recording a condominium plat, the issue is that the county commissioners may not refuse to record a condominium plat solely because it creates condominiums. And there's nothing in the record that would suggest that the county commissioners refuse to record this condominium plat solely because it created condominiums. In fact, they had approved the site development plan. They've indicated throughout this case that we have a PUD that lot 12B will have condominiums on it. And in fact, they changed the number of condominiums from 10 condominiums to 16 condominiums, but then the district court reaches the conclusion that you have refused to record the condominium plat solely on the basis that it creates condominiums. And that's clearly not what has occurred here. There's no substantial evidence in the record to sustain that finding by the court.
And I understand.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay, isn't one of the real challenges here not so much that the law has changed or even the facts have changed, but the milieu, if you will, has changed from the early 90s when you had a developer that was apparently working in some harmony with the county, and there were some third parties that were actually opposed to this, and that's why this agreement was reached. They were trying to prevent a lawsuit from third parties. And then we moved through three decades, and now we have a commission that isn't as buddy-buddy with the developer as it was before, and we just have different priorities as a county and as the developers and the people that originated this process.
I don't believe it's quite that simple, because the same people who were opposed to the original PUD and who were involved in the process to ensure that the PUD was developed in a fashion that was acceptable to the community are also the residents of the county and continue to be involved in these very same issues, and in fact became an intervener in the LUPA case.
In fact, some of them may even be working for the county now. I mean, it's just things that
yes.
kind of change.
Yeah, that is correct. I now want to try to address Justice Thon's question with regard to the settlement agreement. We believe that Judge Boyce made the correct decision that the county had not breached any settlement agreement because they, first of all, you have to look at the settlement agreement, and paragraph 2 indicates what the covenants are between the parties, and there's nothing in there that says that the county will waive requirements for them to comply with the law. So, for example, one of the conditions of this PUD is that you can't have any septic tanks. So if we were here today and instead this dispute was over septic tanks, we would all be sitting back scratching our heads and say, well, of course that condition applies. You can't have septic tanks in that type of vicinity next to the Teton River. That makes absolutely no sense. So you would say, well, let's go ahead and enforce that. And the only thing that Teton County has attempted to do throughout this proceeding is to ensure compliance with the law as they understand that law. And the terms of the settlement agreement, there is no covenant wherein Teton County agrees to waive their right to enforce the law. And that is what the finding the judge made. We believe that is a correct finding. The error we believe that the judge made was in the standard that he used for determining attorney's fees. This court has held that where there is a contract that modifies the terms of who is entitled to attorney's fees, that modification then dictates the award of attorney's fees and not Rule 54. And unfortunately, the court used Rule 54 for that determination.
So, Mr. Hall, if we determined that the case law that says you don't have to be the prevailing party under Rule 54 was wrongly decided, and we do think you have to be the prevailing party, would that end the county's claim for attorney's fees?
I don't believe it would, because we are the prevailing party with regard to count one, which is the breach of contract.
But if there are mixed findings of prevailing, which I think Judge Boyce determined, wouldn't that prevent you from obtaining attorney's fees?
If the court were to create new law, yes. If the court were to file existing precedents, then no.
We have a case in front of us in a different matter, but that question has been asked.
And I'm, of course, not acquainted with that case. But
which prompts my question.
Thank you.
But as I understand it, you're only asserting a right to fees for the breach of contract claim under the settlement agreement, not fees for the declaratory judgment action.
Correct.
Okay.
We made it very clear in our memorandum of cost and fees that we set out very clearly only that portion that applies to the breach of contract. Thank you.
Mr. Brunson, sir.
Thank you. May it please the court. I want to echo what Mr. Lewis said earlier about thank you for being here in Bingham County today. I caught some people in the hallway before that are just here to observe you, and we appreciate you coming to our part of the state. So I just want to sincerely say that at the outset. I'm pleased to represent TCR LLC and its principal, Harry Statter. I had co-counsel in this case, and that was Kathy Spitzer. And for some time, she was the Teton County prosecutor. Some of you may have interacted with her in that capacity. She sends her apologies today. She had a previous commitment in an effort to get this heard as soon as possible. We are pressing forward with just me today. So with that being said, the place I want to start with the Constitution. And it's not every argument that I get to start with the Constitution. Specifically, the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which says in part, no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Similarly, Idaho Constitution, Section 14, has a similar provision. That's why we're here today. That's what started this entire thing. My client's property rights are being infringed by Teton County. And there were some questions earlier about the motives, but that's what's going on here. There is an attempt to stop them from beneficially using their property. And then the record reflects it. And I could tell from the questions that came earlier that you have looked at the record. And I am fully confident if you do that, that this appeal is going to come out the way it should. Because the record supports and establishes what has gone on here, which is extremely sad to my client and to property owners like him who run into situations such as he's in now. There's an interesting kind of intersection between property law and contract law in this case, which I found fascinating. I've always enjoyed contract law in law school. I went to the University of Idaho College of Law, and I have Professor Henderson for contracts. And as I was kind of surmising about our contractual language in this case, I was reminded, and I ran across a case that I ran across in law school, and I even got out, because I still keep it on my shelf, in my my text. It's Problems in Contract Law. And I'll just show you, since we're doing apparently illustrative exhibits today, that it's well highlighted. But the case is a Judge Cardozo's decision. This is just cited to kind of set the table, so to speak. But in this case, it's a famous case. It's the Wood versus Lucy Lady Duff Gordon case. 222 New York, 88, 1917. That's the reference. But there's a statement in that case that Judge Cardozo makes that I think applies to our situation. He says, "The law has outgrown its primitive stage of formalism, when the precise word was the sovereign talisman and every slip was fatal. It takes a broader view today. A promise may be lacking, and yet the whole writing may be instinct with an obligation imperfectly expressed. If that is so, there is a contract." And, Your Honors, there is a contract here. And we maintain that the express language of the contract has been repeatedly and ongoingly violated by Teton County, specifically the Board of Teton County Commissioners. And it's going on presently as we speak. And so because of that intersection, it is kind of an interesting case. And what I have struggled with was the inconsistency between the favorable ruling that my client got related to declaratory relief and the denial of the contract claim. Those two things don't follow logically in my mind, and I have struggled with that. But that being said, I hope I can shed some light onto my thinking, at least in that regard. Before I do that, I want to stay on the declaratory relief side of things. I feel like the questions that were posited to counsel by specifically you, Justice Zahn, were right on. This site plan is not part of the recorded PUD. This is a legal fiction. This is the classic straw man. And lo and behold, again here today, they actually blew it up so you could see it, thereby confirming again that this all comes back to their insistence that this site plan somehow controls my client's property rights. Nowhere on this thing is there a recorder stamp. Nowhere on this thing is there a signature from the property owner. Albeit this was attached to an affidavit after litigation that went on for years over this development. This is not the PUD. The PUD is a record. We know what the PUD is. And the PUD has everything a PUD should. It deals with open space. It deals with condominiums. This is not part of the PUD. And we know that because fortunately in this case, we have a written settlement agreement. We wouldn't always have that in every case. So any questions about how the PUD came into being, or any questions about, well, what should control, they're all covered in the settlement agreement. The settlement agreement specifically in Section 7 says this controls, this instrument number controls. And if you want to modify this, you've got to do it in writing, and everybody needs to agree to it. Someone who happens to work for Teton County can't submit an affidavit after the fact and change that. And I feel like this court, based on its questions, has adequately addressed that.
So let me ask you about your declaratory judgment claim, because
yes,
the only code section I see you plead in there is 55-1523, which, as Mr. Hall talked about, prohibits refusing to accept a plat solely because the project involves condominiums. And that's the code section I see Judge Boyce address. But as you've just covered, the county has taken the position that this site plan controls. And so their reason for not agreeing to accept and record condominium plat is not because it has condominiums on it, but is because it doesn't comply with what they believe is a controlling site plan. And so I can't make out how that violates 55-15-23, because it wasn't a refusal to accept based on the fact that it was a condominium development.
Well, I think you need to look at the entire condominium statute as a whole, because there's specific requirements in the condominium statute that need to be met.
Right, but where Judge Boyce focuses his holding on a violation of 1523, I mean, I agree you may have had a great claim under 1508, for example, but that's not what he based his holding on. He concluded it was a violation of 1523, and so help me understand, where's the evidence in the record to support his conclusion that the county refused to record this solely because it involved condominiums?
Because the only reason that they were giving at the time was the site plan. And he said the site plan doesn't control anything. That's not a legal reason to be giving. That's not a proper reason. He said inappropriate is what he says in his decision. That's the language he uses.
Right, but when they approved the PUD, it was for condominiums.
Correct.
And so how is the refusal now because it has condominiums? My point is, I don't see them taking issues with condominiums. I see them focusing on the site plan.
That's exactly right. But to do so is illegal, is the point I'm making. And whether it's under that statute, we certainly were before the court asking for a writ of prohibition. We were before the court asking for declaratory relief. The writ of prohibition referred to the insignificant plat amendment process or the substantial plat amendment process. They were trying to force us down. That's relief. That's in our prayer for relief and in the body of our complaint. All of those things were improper.
Right.
And
but
the statute, go ahead.
Doesn't the record reflect, though, a genuine issue of material fact about the reasons why Teton County refused to record the plat, whether it was due solely to the fact that it concerned condominiums or it was due to the site plan?
The only reason they gave, this is our position, is the site plan. And because that's not a lawful reason to give. You know, ignorance of the law is not a defense. I don't know how many times I've heard that in my law practice. I would certainly think it's applied to a county who's seeking the assistance of legal counsel. And the law here is that this doesn't control. That should be beyond dispute, but here we are today with a blow-up looking at it. That's a legal fiction, and they were trying to rely on that legal friction. That's the only reason they gave. So if that is unlawful, then that is the only reason they were throwing up. So by virtue of the statute, reading it in conjunction with the other statutes that we have, it needed to be accepted, approved, and recorded. Those were the three things. And for whatever reason, too, while we're on this point, his decision only talks about accepting and recording. It's like approving got lost somewhere in the shuffle. And the reason I'm bringing that up, Justice Zahn, is because we got problems with that later. So we get the declaratory relief. And how we get there is because they were just putting up this illegal site plan and they were trying to force us to go down a plat amendment process when we weren't seeking to amend our PUD plat. And the conjunction of those two things allowed us to get declaratory relief that the court said, well, that's the only thing that you're saying dictates here, then I can allow this plat to be recorded. And otherwise, the plat would have just sat there in perpetuity. What else? What other avenues would we have had to get our condominium plat recorded? We needed, as Gary Armstrong, the Teton County Employee Planning Administrator, says repeatedly, the whole purpose of doing the condominium plat is just to get legal descriptions so you can move forward with the development. You can get building permits, you can market the property, and so on.
And wouldn't it be, the relief you're seeking sounds more like mandamus. A writ of mandamus under 55-1508. So when you ask the question, what other relief, what other avenue, why didn't you file a writ of mandamus?
Well, certainly I think it's the facts giving rise to a writ of mandamus, or the facts giving rise to a declaratory relief, or the facts giving rise to an injunction, which I think is another name for mandamus. I mean, I've looked at that in the past. They're all there. We're saying we have a condominium plat. We want to get it recorded. That's the relief we were after, and that's pretty clear. And a lot of legal thought went into trying to just get this in front of the court the proper way. And could we have been more precise? I will acknowledge, yes. And if that's what we would have needed to specifically write out, great. But what we did is we clearly put this before the court, and it reaches certain points that, and I don't want to be overly what I would call pert happily. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the reference, but sometimes judges need to judge. We look, and in this case, that happened to us over and over again. We had a reluctance on the part of the district judge to judge and just move forward, and not just on this issue, but other issues. So he gave us the relief, but then when immediately the county continued to throw up obstacles and block out the signature on the plat, we said, well, wait a minute, that's going to cause us problems down the road. We need the signature of the Board of County Commissioners. That's what started this whole process.
Well, in fairness, counsel, too, aren't some of these potential mandamus issues things that arose during the course of the case?
They absolutely are.
For example, that's what necessitated your motion to enforce.
That's exactly right. And we tried to bring those to the court's attention. And could our motion to enforce been, captioned mandamus? Maybe it could. But we certainly, that's the relief we're asking for. We were asking.
Captioned contempt.
Yes, it could, Your Honor. And I believe that it was. But that being said, they block out the signature. We go to the district court and we say, Judge, they blocked out the signature. This is going to cause us problems. He said, no, this was done pursuant to court order. This isn't going to cause you problems. And then we get all the way through the process. We get our building permits. The thing goes up on appeal. And what do? They revoke our building permits. And the reason they give us, no signature on the plat. That's the reason they gave us. That's in the record. The other reason they give us is that we needed to go through the plat amendment process. Judge Boyce's decisions addresses that squarely and more than once. All of this, and what, so we go to the, it's up on appeal, so we cite a, I imagine, not a frequently cited provision of the Idaho appellate rules. I did not find any authority on this 13B13. This is in my career, and I've been practicing as long as many in the room, but I've been practicing a lot. I've never run across that before. But I looked at that, and I thought, this clearly fits the situation. 13B13. His early orders made it clear that this was at least a valid condominium plat, and if that's the reason you're giving to deny these building permits and revoke these building permits, then we need to go back to the status quo, and we need to allow the development to move forward. And but for whatever reason, the district court did not do that, and so we appealed that issue too. And I realize this is all kind of coming at you at once, and there is an intersection. But I want to stay on the breach of contract just for a moment. The express provisions of the contract, specifically in section 2.0, that's one that's been talked about a lot. It talks about, and this is in the record more than once, but starting on the record, page 575, it talks about claims that could be asserted or in any way arise out of regarding the dispute. And so the dispute was defined as the PUD and the three ongoing litigations that had happened in the past. And clearly what's happening here is are issues the county is causing for whatever reason that arise out of this PUD and arise out.
Let me ask you about that, because when I look at page 2 of the settlement agreement, it appears to define the disputes as litigations 1, 2, and 3.
Correct.
I don't see a reference to the disputes encompassing the PUD.
Yes, it references litigations 1, 2, and 3, but those litigations all deal with, if you go through them.
Challenges to the approval. Challenges to the county's approval of the PUD.
Correct. Okay. I don't think there's any question that's the subject matter. Well, I don't think there is, I should say. And I appreciate the question, Justice Sun. But while we're at it, on page 2 of the contract, and this goes both to the express contract, like if future contracts is based on the plain language, but also the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And I'm at this point saying Idaho has adopted the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And that's the reason I mentioned the Cardozo opinion at the start. And if there were any question about the intent of this agreement, paragraph B says, to remove obstacles to the construction of the Teton Creek Resort project. That's the reason the agreement was done. And to argue otherwise and to find otherwise, I don't think it's supportable. There's no path to do that.
Could you address then Judge Boyce's argument that reliance on Section B, which he deems a recital provision, isn't really a part of the contract that you can breach because that sets forth the goals. It doesn't necessarily set forth the duties. And usually when you bring a breach of contract action, it's because one party failed to live up to a duty, not that some goal wasn't achieved. I got the impression that was the gist of the case.
Yes, and I will probably do so in a more relaxed manner than maybe this body's comfortable with. But to me, the recitals are to fill in the blanks sometimes, right? I mean, if there's a question about what the intent was or what these parties were trying to accomplish, you can go back to the, generally speaking, you can go back to the recitals and they will fill in those blanks. And so I don't think
the recitals usually are explaining what we hope to achieve here. It doesn't set forth the duties, does it? I mean, usually you don't cite the recitals for a breach of contract, do you?
It just depends. I probably have in the past, if you're asking that. But I mean, I've dealt with a lot of different types of disputes. But in this contract, it's interesting, because if you turn the page to page 3, it says, now therefore, in consideration of the foregoing, which I read as the recitals, because that's the only thing that came before. So that's an express reference to the recitals. There's an argument to be made that adopts those into the contract itself. And then if you read further, it says, and the other matters contained in the recitals above. So, again, the recitals are mentioned in the body of the agreement itself.
But then it says at B, right after the other matters contained in the recitals above, it says the parties represent, warrant, and agree as follows. And so we would only potentially reach the recitals if the promises were ambiguous, right?
I think that's one instance you can reach. And the case law on that certainly talks about ambiguity and talks about that's a time you can do it, but it's a little bit more open-ended than that. I think there could potentially be other scenarios in which you could get into the recitals. I think generally speaking, that's correct, Justice Sonnen. I think generally speaking, Justice Mueller, that I think I agree with that's normally the use of recitals. But here, it's being asserted that the county didn't agree not to throw up obstacles to this PUD.
Now I want to take you to page 5 of the agreement, in which the agreement says, provided the same are reasonably in accordance with the recorded plat defined at paragraph 7.1. It seems to me that Judge Boyce relied heavily on that language in concluding that there wasn't a breach of contract there, and I want to hear your response to that conclusion.
Yes.
Did the agreement contemplate that the PUD would be reasonably in accordance with what had been approved, and is this reasonably within the contemplation of the parties?
So the agreement actually does, in my opinion, say the PUD controls. The PUD is gospel. The PUD is what controls, which as soon as they start to try and bring in other things to the PUD and say they control, that's a breach. So as soon as they started trying to assert the site plan as controlling the development, but not just assert it, but actively prevent us from developing the property, that's a breach. The benefit, so when you're looking at the implied covenant...
I agree with you. If the contemplation of the development had been two buildings, all of the condominiums contained in those two buildings, I'm not sure that I'm in agreement that changing that plan is in contemplation of this agreement.
Again, the plan is contained in the PUD. If you look at the PUD, that is the plan for the development. This is not part of the PUD. And so when this is making, and I'm going to find the language, when it's referring, so the language Yeah, it says, provided the same are reasonably in accordance with the recorded plat. This here is not the recorded plat. We have a recorded plat, which is the PUD itself, which is attached to the complaints throughout the record. That's what it's referring to. Our whole contention in this case is they're trying to superimpose this on top of the recorded plat, despite the written settlement agreement. And I know there's a lot of plats and a lot of maps and things we're talking about in this case, but this is not the recorded plat. It never has been. And I think that's what the point Justice Song was making with her questions earlier today. This is not part of the recorded plat. So when this says this, we completely agree that provided the same are reasonably in accordance with the recorded plat. Yes, we agree with that language. That's a basis for us to say, if you're trying to stray from the PUD by imposing site non-existent site conditions or whatever else you're trying to impose, maybe you say we have to paint all the houses in the subdivision purple.
And so help me understand, that paragraph begins with ad hoc, CTV, and CARP further agree that they, individually or jointly, and it goes on to talk about what they agree to do, and that's where we get the language will not raise or cause to be raised, and it talks about provided the same or reasonably in accordance with the recorded plat. So where in that paragraph is Teton County agreeing not to do anything?
I don't know specifically where you're referring, Justice, but I think I know what you're asking. So let me
I'm at the bottom of page 4.
Page 4, that's where I'm at too. So the preceding paragraph is a broader paragraph that I believe encompasses everything in the more specific paragraph that's in paragraph 4.
Are you talking about the first paragraph, effective upon execution of this agreement?
Yes, the first full paragraph of 2.0 where it says arising or out of or regarding the dispute.
Except that waives all claims or releases all claims, which the party ever had or now has, but are asserted or could be asserted to or in any way related to the dispute, which are the three pieces of litigation. So I'm struggling to understand how this argument over the site plan was a claim that the county could have raised in one of these three lawsuits that happened in the mid-1990s.
I appreciate the question, and it talks about the future, too. It talks about you can't cause controversies in the future. That's how I read that entire paragraph. It says, from the beginning of time to the end of the world, specifically, is what the agreement says.
And that's a rather unique provision,
yeah.
You must admit.
Yeah.
I would agree.
But I have rule against perpetuities concerns about such language.
Fair enough. And it's a great question. And that's where we get into the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Because there is no question, in my mind, based on the plain language of this agreement, and this is where I was going with you, Justice Dinger, that there is a benefit to TCR, or its predecessor in interest, that this is the PUD and it controls. And to the extent you're going to try and prevent that, and that's in 7.1 and 7.2, and to the extent you're going to try and create obstacles and do things, that breaches that benefit to TCR.
Is there any evidence in the record that Judge Boyce could have looked to where he could conclude that ad hoc, CTV, or CARP were acting at the behest of the county?
Oh, back, you're getting into the alignment of the parties.
Well, again, I'm getting into what that paragraph at the bottom of page 4 is talking about and who it seems to be aimed at. It seems to be aimed at those three parties who were protesting this when it was originally imagined and first proposed. I'm just wondering, for your argument, for that paragraph to be applicable here, doesn't there have to be some nexus between the county's actions and those three groups?
As we sit here today or back then?
Now.
Yeah, so the nexus we have now is who we know the players are in this case, and that is Barb. This is in the record, and I'll just give it to you because we're short on time.
Now, I know who Bard is for obvious reasons, but I'm not sure everybody else does. Bard isn't named in here.
Yeah, Bard intervened in the sister action, and Bard is mentioned throughout these proceedings. And let me tell you, okay, so I'm going to read from my outline. I apologize, but I want to be precise. I see Justice Zahn acknowledging that. Teton is working with Bard, the successor of the ad hoc, CTV, and CARP parties to the settlement agreement at issue in this case. Bard specifically stated that the activist groups were the predecessor organization and that we still actively represent the signatories of that settlement agreement to this very day. That's in the record at volume 1, page 103.
So essentially then BART is a successor in interest to these three entities.
That's what BART
is. Is involved in this.
Yes.
Directly.
Yes.
Through the county.
And when I deposed Commissioner Hennage, it revealed that he was emailing BART. It revealed that other facts in the record revealed that BART was the one that brought up this site plan idea to the Billy Sidway, the prosecuting attorney, and who's the Teton County prosecuting attorney. So we have all those facts in the record to show that the county essentially now, or at least the Board of County Commissioners, appears to be in league with BART. And be that as it may, regardless of whether they're in league with, there's no question that there's a benefit to the contract that my client should be able to rely not on this document, but on the recorded PUD. And that's codified in the settlement agreement. And to the extent any party to that contract, whether it be the predecessors in interest of BART or whether it be the county or even my client, to the extent any of those parties want to impair that benefit, that the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing kicks in.
So is any amendment to the PUD considered a violation of this agreement then, even if it was an amendment that your client requested?
No, because the settlement agreement contemplates amendments and says we can sign off on it.
So it's just an amendment that frustrates the original purpose as set forth in the recital?
That's correct. Okay, my time is short, and there's a few questions I'd love to expound more on. I'm confident if you read the decisions of Judge Boyce, I don't believe those decisions are consistent. And I just want to end with this. This statement. And this case was cited, but for a different reason. This comes out of Cooper versus Board of County Commissioners of Ada County. Quote, "It is clear there is a pressing need in Idaho for established standards and procedures by which particularized land use regulation is to be administered. To allow the discretion of local zoning bodies to remain virtually unlimited in the determination of individual rights is to condone government by men rather than government by law. And what we really need here is government by law. And this court has the ability to right that wrong. It has the ability to not just reverse the breach of contract, it has the ability to reverse the two motion to enforce decisions and right the ship, so to speak. And because of that, I'll go back to the statement I made earlier. I'm asking you to judge, and I'm asking you to judge in accordance with the law and the record in this case, and I'm confident if you do that, you will rule in favor of TCR. I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Clerk, how much time remains for the appellant?
8 minutes, sir.
8 minutes, sir.
Thank you. We've gone quite far afield because we seem to be quoting from the companion case more than we are from this actual case that's before the court, for the attempts by counsel to sustain the decision of Judge Boyce. So I want to try to focus back on the decision of Judge Boyce for a moment. First of all, they've had quite a discussion about an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. I would challenge any of you to search the pleadings in this case and see where that cause of action has been pled. It has not. It's never pled. Even if it had been pled, Judge Boyce made it very clear that there was no such breach. We think that the court should acknowledge that when you don't plead a cause of action, you don't get to raise it during a summary judgment proceeding. That's what this court has previously held. Now, focusing on the case itself, they asked for relief under 55-1523, Condominium Act. There's no requirement under 55-1523 that county commissioners approve a condominium plat. Now, there is that you can't deny recording of a condominium plat solely for the purposes that it creates condominiums. The evidence is replete in this case that the county commissioners did not denied this plat in their June, in their October 13th meeting, 2020, on the basis that solely because it was creating condominiums. And yet that is the decision that Judge Boyce reached, which is clearly in error. Now, they came subsequently and asked for the court to enforce his prior order and require the county commissioners to sign the plat. That wasn't the relief they ever requested in their complaint. And the relief that was granted under 55-1523 doesn't require county commissioners to sign. In fact, my own experience is that we build something, and then after we build it, we decide that we're going to sell it as condominiums, and then you come in and record a plat, never have county commissioners sign that, never is required, and then the whole purpose of that condominium plat is to enable you to be able to transfer the properties because you now have legal descriptions.
Isn't that the county's position, though, that they have to sign it before building permits can be issued?
That is correct.
So it does have to be signed.
If you want building permits. But they've never requested building permits as part of the relief in this litigation, although they filed a second motion to ask the court to enforce, and the court said, you never asked me to require building permits. Now, generally, when you're going to have a plat to go to the county before the county commissioners, commissioners require a hearing and make a determination as to whether to approve it or not. Finally, may I suggest that what was before this court, before Judge Boyce, was a need to determine, pursuant to the City of Eagle versus Two Rivers, what in fact did the developer present at public meetings to which they should be bound to. The county argued that this is what was presented, the site development plan.
Based on what evidence?
Based on the Nemeth affidavit.
She does not say that was presented at a public meeting.
I realize that. I was just about to add, and the minutes from the county planning and zoning meeting. My point is simply that what should occur in this case is not a rush to a summary judgment, but actually an evidentiary proceeding where the parties are able to present to the court what in fact was presented to P&Z and to the county commissioners that would have enabled this PUD to be approved. If that is what is done, then we are then consistent with the City of Eagle and Two Rivers. And in fact, we can make a determination as to what and how this development should occur. Rather than simply saying, I'm the new big guy in town, I've decided that I'm going to develop this subdivision completely contrary to what all the public believed it was ever going to occur, because I can. And I'm going to. That flies in the face of allowing the public themselves and the local elected officials to make a determination to their own zoning ordinances and that should be applied in these types of cases.
May I ask you a question about the breach of contract action and the judge's decision? One concern I had was with the portion where on page 10 of the district court's decision on the motion for summary judgment, it indicated that the actions that the county's taking, including their refusal to allow recordation of the condominium plat, didn't constitute a breach of contract because this was merely an errant regulatory action. And I have a question about that phrase, regulatory action. It almost sounds like it was just a ministerial act with no bad intent. Therefore, it's not a material breach. Given the history on this case, I'm just wondering if that's a naive conclusion, that this was merely a regulatory act as opposed to a calculated decision and strategic, which I don't think would be a mere regulatory act.
Under Rider Code 1523, it is a regulatory act. That is how I at least interpret the Condominium Act. It is a regulatory act. That's why I've never submitted condominium plats to a county commission for approval. And they did, in fact, comply with the judge's order and recorded. Now, they had not had an approval.
Only after they were required to, forced to, by judicial caveat, correct?
Correct.
So that hardly seems regulatory to me. That seems like they were kicking and screaming to doing something they didn't want to do.
Well, the county sometimes get various items presented to them for recording. And the question comes on, are we required to record them or not?
Sure. They sometimes have tax protesters wanting to file all kinds of exotic, I get that. But this was directly connected to ongoing litigation. I don't see how they could have made that kind of mistake here.
There was not any ongoing litigation at the time they created the litigation. The first case was this deck action. There wasn't any ongoing litigation. Other litigation involving this case had been resolved 28 years earlier. So there was no ongoing litigation.
So based on the timing, then, do you think that's correct?
I do. Finally, with regard to that settlement agreement, I think this court is well aware of the language that's in paragraph 2A, and the parties were aligned at the time this agreement was signed. And it specifically indicated which party was coming to do what act. And as Judge Boyce found, there was never any covenant by the county not to enforce the law and to require the parties to comply with all future building requirements, whether it's zoning, whether it's fire code, whether it's building code.
I appreciate your remarks. Your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Thank you. We appreciate it. The matter is under advisement. We will render a decision in this case. Be in recess until tomorrow at 10 a.m. at Bennington.
All rise, please.